This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Well, good afternoon, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. So our question today is, how was the Civil War memorialised by both sides? Who won the memory wars? Now, to address these and other questions, I'm joined by, on my immediate left here, Conor Dodd, resident historian here at Glasnevin Cemetery and author of Casualties of Conflict, Fatalities of the War of Independence and Civil War in Glasnevin Cemetery. And that was just recently published by Mercer Press. To his left, John Dorney, editor of the Irish Story website and author of The Civil War in Dublin, The Fight for the Irish Capital, 1922 to 1924. And that was published by Irish Academic Press in 2017. On my right, Mary McAuliffe, assistant professor and director of gender studies at UCD and author of Margaret Skinner, published by UCD Press in 2020. And finally, Caitlin White, a postdoctoral research fellow in the School of Education, Trinity College, Dublin. And this HedgeGhoul is supported by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media under the Decade of Centenaries 2012 to 2023 initiative and by Phibsborough Community Arts Festival, otherwise known as FizzFest. Now, to get us started, now we have a number of images here behind me. Our first image here, we don't go very far. You can actually just look out the window and you'll see what's on the image here behind me. This is Michael Collins' grave. Conor, you're the local man here. Talk to us just about Glasnevin itself, because it has a unique role to play in the whole question of memorialisation. I mean, it's like one big memorial out there.
Yeah, and a lot of people would obviously be familiar with Glasnevin in terms of the famous figures from that period and from the Civil War who are buried here. I suppose it's worth pointing out at the outset that Glasnevin and the Dublin Cemetery Trust is an independent body. So it wasn't at that time of the Civil War or before or after it, overseen or operated by any government department or body or indeed Dublin Corporation. And that's an important thing, I suppose, to say, because it places in context a lot of the relationships that occurred in terms of the memorialisation of the Civil War. And even going back to that early period of the foundation of the cemetery in the 1830s, there was a very clear idea of it as this idea of a national pantheon, as was popular during the period. And there was a lot of planning that went into that idea and kind of the political importance of the cemetery and the burials that would take place here due to that. And because of that, throughout the 19th century and then obviously up to that point of the revolutionary period, Glasnevin has a very important place for a lot of different groups and a lot of different people coming from different political perspectives. So you have a situation whereby the Republican plot is placed in a unique position, it's probably fair to say, after the funeral of O'Donovan Rossa and the speech of Patrick Pearse there. And you get a lot of prominent burials that take place there from the 1916 Rising and the War of Independence. And in that period in between the truce and the start of the Civil War, there's kind of a neutral stance in terms of respecting the rights of both sides to inter dead there, but that is put on hold when the Civil War breaks out, and essentially the people who hold the keys to that plot are on the anti-treaty side. So essentially that becomes an anti-treaty plot at that point, and the National Army, the pro-treaty side, decamp to their own plot, which is the one that we see there with the grave of Michael Collins. So you have that segregation happening, and you see that mirroring, I suppose, of the political turmoil and conflict being placed within the cemetery. And similarly, then as well, you have that situation when the split occurs in later years with Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil gain control, essentially, of the Republican plot. And Republicans then are kind of pushed out to the periphery into other spaces of the cemetery, where they then kind of memorialise the dead of the period and have both in terms of St. Paul's section across the road and then more isolated and different graves. So all of these things are reflected within the cemetery, and you can very much see how not just the Civil War, but also the post Civil War political situation within the country is reflected here in the cemetery.
So from what you're saying is it just develops organically. You know, what's now the Republican plot, National Army plot, and so on. There wasn't a plan as such.
Yeah, that's a fair point, particularly in terms of the National Army plot, because they're forced, I suppose, very quickly in the midst of the fighting in Dublin to open that plot. And there isn't at that point really a plan in terms of you know, what is this plot? Who does it memorialise? It has a very practical purpose as the National Army's burial place. But you can see that certainly in the short term and in the medium term that, say, for example, Richard Mulcahy sees it as in a very simplistic way, which is that this is a national monument to the Civil War and to Michael Collins and the people who tried to put in place his policies. For example, W.T. Cosgrave, he kind of shies away from it and he kind of looks and says, well, we can't really do anything with this, you know, at this point in time. After 20 years, we'll be able to look back and, you know, retrospectively kind of consider what this monument is. And you can see as well, developing within that at the same time, I suppose the National Army as well in 1924, you know, they put in place a rule in relation to the National Army plot where they say that only those with pre-truce service can be buried in it. So you can see their own kind of disquiet and unease, I think, at some of the burials that have taken place there. You know, what do they mean? Even, I suppose, maybe questioning the legitimacy of those who had died in the National Army during the Civil War. So all of these things are reflected, not just through the burials, but through the plots themselves and the politics that were attached to them.
John, can I just go to you? Because you're working on a project at the moment which will finally give us a figure for how many people were killed in the Civil War. Is that correct? You are going to give us a figure eventually.
That is correct.
Okay, no, I just want to get an idea, just because we're talking about commemorations and already Connor's mentioned the National Army plot. So how many National Army, Free State Army guys were killed in the Civil War, roughly?
So I'm going to have to give you one of those annoying, complicated answers, Tommy.
Oh, no.
No. So taking the Civil War in a broad context, so the expansive dates, so from the time the treaty was signed up until 1924, when most of the National Army was demobilized, you have in and around 800, possibly 900, depending on how you count fatalities, people killed serving in the National Army.
That's half of the total, and more than half of the total.
Well over half of the total, because now taking what we have at the moment is with University College Cork, UCC, and what we have at the moment is a figure for the official Civil War, which is June 28, 1922, until May 24th, 1923. And the figure we have so far is 1,400, roughly. Now, of that, the single largest category is indeed the National Army. Not all of whom were killed in action. Quite a few of them were killed in accidents. Some of them died of illness, which is common in wars, actually. It's the norm. But roughly, I mean, within that figure, around 600 plus are National Army. Around 500, short of 500, are anti-treaty. And you have 200 to 300 civilians is what we have roughly so far.
Okay. Relatively low number of civilians killed compared to the War of Independence.
Much less. So one of the features of the Civil War is actually that civilians are killed in significant numbers, like 200 to 300 killed in Ireland in 9 months is quite a lot by our standards. But in comparison to the War of Independence, there's far less killed because they're not getting targeted systematically as informers. The IRA did not do that. They're banned from doing it by Liam Lynch during the Civil War, for most of the Civil War. Changes his mind at the very end. There isn't a great deal of civilians killed in intercommunal violence because we don't count the Civil War as taking place in the North. Although, of course, there was hundreds killed in the North in that time frame. But talking about the 26 counties, you don't have that. You don't see the same indiscriminate killing of civilians by state forces that you do before the truce. So the British forces are famously undisciplined. They're opening fire at anything that moves. And while there are occasions where both sides kill civilians at checkpoints and so on in the Civil War, not in the same numbers at all. Mostly the majority of people killed are combatants in the Civil War.
Okay, what I'm getting at is there's more National Army guys killed than anti-treaty IRA. So I'm just, if you want to be proportionate, you would expect you'd have more National Army monuments, but there isn't. And that's what I want to come on to later. Now, I just want to stick up our next slide here is the Béal na Bláth monument where Michael Collins was killed. How important was Collins then to the pro-treaty memorialisation of the Civil War?
He's extremely important, but one thing to note is that in the 20s and 30s, Tommy, the pro-treaty commemoration day, yes, Béal na Bláth, August 22nd, but the pro-treaty commemoration day is actually August the 2nd for Arthur Griffith. And so there's a memorial to Griffith and Collins, the cenotaph, which people won't be familiar with because it's not there anymore, but it was placed outside of Leinster House. And that's, we're going to see that in a sec. Yeah. Sorry for jumping on there, Tommy. But that is actually, there's actually a pro-treaty military march originally that used to pass by the cenotaph on August the 7th. And as late as 1933, which is, you know, in the period of the blue shirts in the 1930s, the Civil War is almost replayed as farce, you know, as Mark said. But Owen O'Duffy, who by that point is the head of the blue shirts, wants to march on the cenotaph on August the 7th to mark Griffiths and Collins. And by that time, Kevin O'Higgins, who was assassinated in 1927. And so originally, it's actually Griffiths Day, which is the big one. However, I mean, Collins, of course, is the big romantic figure. And the other thing is, and this is one point to make about pro-treaty commemoration, is what Collins represents, which Griffith doesn't represent so strongly at all, is the pro-treaty kind of militarist Republican tradition. And this is the bedrock of pro-treaty commemoration. So you mentioned there's a lot less pro-treaty commemoration. There is. Where they are, almost to a man, and they are all men, unfortunately, married.
Yeah, yeah.
Almost to a man, they're pro-treaty IRA men. So the ones, so a great proportion of the National Army served in the British Army before, significant proportion. We don't know. I mean, there's people bandy about a figure of 50%, and I don't know how anyone came up with that figure, but there's certainly a large amount. There's a large amount who had never served in anything before. A lot of them are very young. I mean, a considerable number of the National Army who died are 16, 17, 18. They're not the ones who are commemorated. So it's very rare to find a commemoration of a pro-treaty soldier who hadn't been in the IRA before. Yeah. Because there is a coterie of the pro-treaty side who believe that they are the true heirs of the IRA and so on. And they're the ones who have commemorations. So you have Collins, of course, who is the most prominent of them. You have, for example, Sean Hales, who's also a TD, who was commemorated in a statue in Bandon in Cork. You have Joe Ring in County Mayo, who again had been an IRA commandant. And you have, for example, Tom Keogh, who was a member of the squad, Collins' squad, who was killed by a landmine with six other soldiers in Cork. And there's not only is there's a big volunteer memorial at his grave, but there's also a memorial at the spot where he was killed, which is very unusual for the pro-treaty standards. Why? Because that particular pro-treaty group can incorporate it into the Republican tradition. They died for Ireland, is the message. But that's not the dominant pro-treaty voice, certainly by the end of the Civil War. And that's probably why their commemoration is so much less than the other side.
Maybe, Caitlin, could you talk to us about this monument? Because, as I say, people won't be familiar with it because it doesn't exist anymore. And the fact that it's called a cenotaph, I mean, with echoes of your First World War commemoration. Maybe talk to us a bit about that.
Absolutely, yeah. This monument was erected less than 2 months after the Civil War actually finished. So we take that to May 1923. This is erected in August. And
no, so just to say, it looks like it was erected fairly quickly. You know,
it's very quickly
lashed together.
It was actually it was plaster.
Yeah.
So it by the end of 19, so it was erected very quickly. There's a very definite struggle to control the memory of Collins and Griffith and to monopolize that and to secure the legitimacy of the government. They're putting this up in Leinster House to kind of reiterate their possession of the space. But by the end of 1923. This is already starting to show signs of decay. It was not meant to be a permanent monument. This was meant to be something that was temporary. It only cost them about £830 and was put up within 2 months. It stays there for far longer than intended. I mean, it's replaced in 1949 with the cenotaph that we have there today.
But so if you wonder, guys, you know that needle on the back of the back lawn, the one that nobody knows what is about. That's what it is. It's a pro-treaty monument. But is it what is it officially, that little slender?
Well, that is the cenotaph that's there today is a monument to the Civil War.
Generally.
So you can see.
So it's shifted. So the memory, its purpose has shifted.
Purpose has shifted hugely because by the time it's put up in 1949, so the Cumannagale government, they promise they're spending £830 on this. It's going to be a temporary monument, but they need something for the first anniversary of Griffith and Collins' death. And so they have, you can see there, for those who can see the slide, they have the effigies of Collins and Griffith on the front of the monument itself. But they never put up that permanent monument. They have lots to, they're in financial difficulty, they have lots of debts to repay. The Civil War cost them about £33 million in material damage. It's cost them about £17 million, just the financial running of the Civil War. They then start with the military service pensions. They have over 50 years of financial liability in different forms with the military service pensions. So they never actually get around to put up this permanent replacement. And it's Eamon de Valera and the Fianna Fáil government that give the money to actually put up it. The temporary monument is in such a state of deterioration and decay that it's the Fianna Fáil government then who put up what we have today, the granite cenotaph that has no names. So it's very different in style and I think in intent than the cenotaph that was put up in 1923.
But the result is most people have no idea what it's for.
Most people have. You see it through the gates of you see it through the gates. If you're walking around on Merrion Square, you're looking through the gates into Leinster House, and it's very hard to figure out what it is for.
I mean, it looks nice. I mean, you know, aesthetically it's quite pleasing, but it's a bit like the spire, you know. Anyway. Okay, tell you what, I want to move on our next image here, Mary. Just before we talk about this one in particular, just on the general question, who gets commemorated, who doesn't?
Well, of course, as John said, all of the commemorations are men, number one. And the majority of the commemorations are for the anti-treaty Republican dead throughout the country, if we take the whole 26 counties. And so you could say in many ways, the memory wars begin once the Civil War ends. And while the Free State may have won the Civil War, I would argue that the memory war is still being played out with the winning team being the anti-treaty side at the moment.
But if you control the state, like, does it matter who wins the memory war? Like
it doesn't. I think it also continues a certain relationship with the state if you are on the other side. Yeah. Like, I mean, there Conor was talking about how Glasnevin reflects so many different aspects of our histories. We have people here buried in Glasnevin, buried as Republicans who might have lived on into the 40s, 50s and 60s, like, for instance, Elizabeth O'Farrell, who brought out the surrender flag in 1916, was in Cumann na mBan, was anti-treaty, never accepted the legitimacy of the Irish Free State, and never took a pension, never gave her witness statement to the Bureau of Military History, did not engage with the state and continued to be a political activist and Republican activist. And I think one of the last activisms she did before she died suddenly was talking on the border at the very beginning of the border campaign in the 50s. So Glasnevin holds the bodies of those people who did not engage with the state. They reluctantly lived in a state that obviously they had to engage on a day-to-day level. But in an ideological level, they rejected that state. And then you have commemorations of men like Martin Hogan.
Okay, well, this is a memorial to Martin Hogan. This is in Grace Park Road. And this is one of three or four memorials, this guy's name. So what's wrong with this, Mary? Just give us the backstory here.
It's a common backstory up to the point of what happens that makes it not. He was very much part of the Republican campaign, or the number one Tipperary Brigade during the War of Independence, senior leader of that, very much well known. And then during the truce and early part of the Civil War, throughout the country, not just in Tipperary, there is a lawlessness. There are certain land issues and personal issues that are being dealt with without recourse to the police, because they're, you know, with the delegitimacy, I suppose, of the RIC, the withdrawal of the Crown forces, and before the civic guard is really in place and set up, it is the local IRA brigades that are looking after local areas. And oftentimes, when a lot of younger men are coming in, and there is a certain lawlessness, and they're stealing alcohol and they're attacking pubs, there is an attack by Martin Hogan and his brother and the Grace brothers and a few others to the Biggs house in Drumminear in County Tipperary, in which Mrs. Biggs is gang raped by the gang who attacked the house. Definitely Martin and his brother and the two Grace brothers are involved in that attack. Now, the Martin goes on the run. Hogan goes on the run to Dublin, where he continues his activism as an anti-treatyite here in Dublin. And he is shot, probably by the Oriel House gang in Grace
Park. Shot while trying to escape.
But his brother and the two other guys were arrested in Tipperary. And recently I saw, and thanks to Sean Hogan for all his help, who's in the audience here, in pointing me towards material, the documents of their arrest and their being bound to the peace because of the attack on the Biggs household in Drumminer in County Tipperary, which indicates that they were to stay away also, not just the house, but specifically from Mrs. Biggs. So while people say that there is no proof, there was no trial, they weren't charged, and they weren't found guilty, there is no doubt that they were involved in that raid on the Biggs household, and Mrs. Biggs was gang raped. She has a pretty horrific afterlife after that. And here we have Martin Hogan, who did that. And not only does he have this in Grace Park Road, he's on the main monument in the centre of Nina to the Republican dead. And I believe another monument has gone up to him. Two more monuments have gone up to him this year. And so we have to question, do we commemorate everyone who fought? Do we just overlook aspects of their character and what they did outside of what would be considered the military activism, the military action? Why do we think it is, you know, proper to commemorate a man who committed such a horrible act of sexual violence in war? In our contemporary world, we bring those who commit sexual violence, if they can be found, to justice, to bring them to The Hague or under the Geneva Conventions. Rape as a weapon of war is outlawed. And yet here we have four commemorations of a man who obviously was involved in...
And re-erected in 2003. I mean, only
yes, it was,
like 20 years ago.
And two others went up this year as well in the as part of the centenary of his death. So there are questions I think we have to ask. Do we commemorate everyone simply because they died or were killed as part of war? And I think we have to ask those questions in this period now where we're talking about, like, the Berkeley Library in Trinity has been denamed because of the association of George Berkeley, not his philosophy or whatever, but because he supported slavery and was himself a slave owner. And people say, oh, we can't bring down monuments because then we won't know our history. Monuments don't teach us history. Monuments tell us about who we want to commemorate, who it's important for us to commemorate because of our own ideological and political standpoints.
Although, Mayor, so, I must say, because of work yourself and people, I can't remember the names, all the people involved in looking at this question of violence against women, this monument has been shown repeatedly, right, in public forums.
Yes,
you know,
true.
So I think this one's been given a good airing.
We educate. Even though it has been shown repeatedly, and this story has been common currency, I'd say, now for the last 5 years. Would you say,
And I presume
monuments
people,
still went up to him this year.
Yeah, but the people who erected it would have done so quite innocently, presumably.
No, it was always known.
Really?
It was
always
known that there was questions about it.
You're right. Well, that's
Sorry to admit that, but even at the time of the case, I mean, it wasn't just, I mean, it's reported widely
in the Nina Guardian and in all the newspapers. It was well known.
Westminster as well. It was a very well known, very popular.
Okay, so it's not one of these big silences.
No. Oh, God.
Right.
And actually, it's one of the few of those sexual violence that happened, particularly in the Civil War, where the word rape is actually used. It's not covered up.
Okay.
Not with the word outrage or indecent assault. Actually, the word rape is actually used.
Just before we bring John in, I should have mentioned this at the outset, that the format of the Head School, you have a listen, but pay attention because you will be asked to participate, just like in school. So if you want to come in the conversation at any stage, not just at the end, just put your hand up and I'll bring you into the conversation. And we do have a roving mic for this purpose. And remember, this has all been recorded, so keep it clean. John.
Just a little comment on the Martin Hogan thing. What's interesting is the Biggs case is important in the early part of 1922, which shows also the importance of context and the meaning people ascribe to stuff, because the meaning that's put on it is like, the loyalists, because Mrs. Biggs was a Protestant, you know, yeah. loyalists are being persecuted in the south of Ireland. You know, the treaty was a terrible mistake. Now, that's all forgotten by April 23, and the context put in it then, like, the army doesn't mention that he was vaunted for break-in and rape, which he was. It says he was responsible for a number of murders here in Dublin, which is the context they care about by that point. So Hogan came to Dublin, and he was actually an ASU member, so he's one of the main guerrilla operators in Dublin, and he's arrested. I mean, the monument actually says Darm the public that a Dunbar assault, which means he was murdered. That's what mm-hmm. happened. They picked him up and they picked him up and they drove him out
and shot him.
And he shot him in the head. But that's the context people remember in April 23, and it does show how, you know, what's going on right now is what people mark. You know, it's were they aware? I mean, it wouldn't have taken an awful lot of digging for Republicans to be aware of the context of the previous year.
I believe they were aware. Certainly in 2003, it was.
They could have been made aware.
There was an awareness. If I could bring in Sean here, you were the one who brought it to my attention. Sean is a local historian of that area in Tipperary. And you, on 2003, you would have known.
Yeah, just wait for the mic there, Sean, if you could. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, good, Donald. It's funny. I mean, being a historian, I didn't know of the case until I was about to publish in 2013. I became aware through Pádraig Yates' writing, and he referenced something which brought it to my attention. But I've talked to people since in the weeks now, because two monuments have gone up in the last 2 weeks to commemorate.
Last 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah, it's a very definite pushback against this, really. There's no question about that. And so I was talking to people locally, and they said, yeah, I remember the buses coming down to the graveyard. One of them is in Kildearn Graveyard, where he's buried. And we were always told, don't go near that, don't go anywhere near that fella, or don't go near. So one man I was talking to was saying that. We were told not to go near that. In more recent times, it was the Airgee section, which were arriving down, which wouldn't have been particularly welcome, I think, in any case, sort of. So they were the more recent ones. And I think when it says re-erected here, I think that monument, the original monument, was broken and smashed back at some stage. I'm not quite sure when.
I think it was broken in a car accident, though. I don't think it was broken. Yeah. I think okay. so. It was broken deliberately by someone. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, I'm just going to move on. I'm just going to move on to the next image here. Connor, bring you in on this one. This is an example of a Comyn Ale poster where the dead are being, I don't know, I mean, manipulated, you could say. Anyway, talk to us about this.
What we have here is a Cumann na Gael election poster, and essentially, I suppose it's the use of the dead of the Civil War for propaganda purposes. Long after, you know, this is 10 years, after the Civil War, and you have an image there, obviously, of De Valera with Ireland, I suppose, pointing at all of these crosses that you can see with the names of Rory O'Connor and Michael Collins and Cathal Brua, Emmett McGarry, Sean Hales and others.
So it's mixed, though. It's pro and anti-treaty.
That's the interesting. And the title there, you can see the dead who died for an empty formula in quotation marks, which is obviously a push at De Valera in terms of kind of references to the oath when they decide to end that policy of abstentionism from Dáil Éireann. And you're correct in saying it's very interesting in that it is a mix of names. You also have people there, you know, like Rory O'Connor, who are executed, you know, retrospectively, essentially, under law that was enacted, during the Civil War. And you've got a cross over the grave of Michael Collins, which is remarkable, really, in a way, in that at that point in Glasnevin, there was no cross over the grave of Michael Collins. You know, they put a cross over the grave of Collins in a poster before they actually put a grave across over the grave of Collins itself. And it's interesting in a way, I suppose, obviously, clearly, look, trying to lay the blame at the feet of De Valera. But also as well, I suppose, when you look at some of the names that are there, for example, like Seamus Dwyer, who was shot in a shop in Dublin, and Bobby Bonfield, who was later picked up in Dublin by the bodyguards of W.T. Cosgrave, and he's never seen alive again. So there's a lot more names that you could add to those crosses. But it's interesting to see how they're willing to use, I suppose, these debts long after the Civil War has ended. And I suppose it points as well, certainly, to a certain unease that Fianna Fáil would have had, you know, with certain aspects of the Civil War. But what's interesting as well is that, you know, when you look at this and you can see that the debt are useful for propaganda, you don't see that kind of translating, I suppose, into memorialization projects, you know, within the cemetery and the memorialization of the Civil War dead, or even, you know, Collins himself at his graveside.
Now, this is something, I think, John, that you mentioned, that the Protreus side are in early, well, because their two main guys are dead, right? Griffith and Collins. And we've already established that the bulk of memorials are anti-treaty. Just talk to us about memorials as propaganda, John, because the point is they've got plenty of new fuel to add to the fire of grievance, if you like.
On
the Republican side and on up to the 1940s, 1950s, and so on.
Yeah. So, you know, commemoration, nobody here will be, I think, disagree with this statement. It's all about the present. It's all about the meaning you want now. So in the early days after the Civil War, one of the things, you see a couple of things. One of the things is you see kind of competitive ownership over who owns the Patriot dead, right? So some of the IRA memorials that go up and afterward in the years afterwards have, you know, people who died in the 1916 Rising and the War of Independence and both sides in the Civil War, but most don't. So mostly it's the anti-treatyites who want to claim the Patriot dead because for their version, for the now, it's about unfinished business. So it's a project that's still ongoing. But what's very interesting is if you look in the papers of the IRA, which are preserved in the Toomey papers in UCD, they're very interested in commemoration at a very early stage. So right after the Civil War, one of the things they tried to do with the units that are still intact and so on is assemble a list of those who were killed in the Civil War. So these a lot of units report back and they include everyone who was killed in the Black and Tan War as well. But what the leadership actually wants is a list of the people who were killed in the Civil War because that's their immediate context. So yes, it's all about the struggle against Britain and for independence, but the immediate context is that you have a free state, which to their mind is, you know, British imposed and everything else. And that's the thing you have to overthrow. So that's what they're thinking of. In an early stage, you have the formation of a thing called the National Graves Association, which we still have with us today, 1926. Now, the National Graves Association themselves will say that they trace the ancestors of their organization back to Fenian times, but 1926, National Graves Association is formed. It is by constitution an apolitical body, but it has dedicated people who died in pursuit of a 32-county Irish Republic. So if it's an apolitical organization, it's certainly not an unideological organization. So the National Graves Association commemorates Republicans on the anti-treaty side only. And so we saw Martin Hogan's memorial. The National Graves Association typically has erected since the early 20s memorials, single memorials to anti-treatyites on the place where they died.
Can I ask you a question? The National Graves Association, did they have real traction? Like, in other words, did they have resources to erect monuments? Like, did they raise money?
They did raise money. I mean, it's like, while again, the National Graves Association is not affiliated with any political organization, in reality, it was in the orbit of the IRA and of the IRA supporters in America.
So it's part of the movement.
It would have been, yeah. And I mean, today, they're
the broader sense. Yeah.
I mean, today, the National Graves Association would be close in the thinking of people who would be against the Good Friday Agreement and so on. Like, I know, and people who were involved in the National Graves Association will object. They have no political affiliation. And in fact, you're banned from having it if you're on the governing body. But they will continue to commemorate people who, to their mind, you know, are in favor of the 32-county Irish Republic without compromise. Now, one of the interesting things, though, is so the anti-treatyites are marked, they're marked unevenly. So they're marked in places where the anti-treaty Republican and including the anti-Fianna Fáil tradition is strong after the Civil War. So there's a lot of them in Dublin. I think there's 25 of those little memorials in Dublin. All over Kerry you can find them, for example. But if you go to somewhere like Laois, for example, there's memorials that are not National Graves Association. They're very unevenly spread around the country because it depends on the political climate in a particular area. Now, one more thing, Tommy, just before I finish on this. So these monuments continue to go up. And the context, of course, changes. So Fianna Fáil joins kind of the political mainstream after 1927. And so the purists, if you like, physical force Republicans, come to regard Fianna Fáil also as traitors. So, for example, in the 1950s, the big monument which people might have seen in Ballyseedy, County Kerry, which is a monument, of course, to the anti-treaty prisoners who were massacred there in 1923, 8 of them blown up at that spot. It's opened in 1959, and it's opened by a man who was around at the time, John Joe Sheehy, who was the commandant of Kerry No. 2 Brigade, which is in South Kerry. But Ballyseedy is near Tralee, it's in North Kerry, for people not familiar. But the only actual survivor of the massacre, Stephen Fuller, who was a Fianna Fáil supporter, was not allowed to participate because, again, it's about the context of the time. And at the time, a Fianna Fáil government had introduced internment for the IRA during the border campaign of the 50s. So again, commemoration, all about the present, all about the meaning, the political mileage in the present day.
Maybe, Mary, bring you in. You've jumped onto Ballyseedy. We'll talk about it now. Just like this went up in 1959. Now, I mean, is it relevant that the sculptor, the Breton Jan Goulet, was a Nazi collaborator? That's a fact.
That's harsh.
Is that harsh?
I mean, he was a Breton nationalist, and he was a member of a militia which was in Vichy France. Nazi collaborator? I don't know. Yeah. His ancestors certainly would reject that.
Mary, any comment on that?
Well, I wouldn't know enough about him himself to say, but I had heard he was a Nazi collaborator.
Just talk a little bit about Kerry, because it's a particular case, right? I mean, this is the sharp end of the Civil War, really, the end of it, the bitter end.
It lasted longer, it's more bitter and protracted. And there's all sorts of reasons for that we spent the head school in when we were at the conference in Kerry talking about the fact that the Dublin Brigade is in Kerry, Paddy O'Daly eventually becoming the commandant in charge in January 23, certainly a man not afraid to use extreme violence to achieve his aims, and had been doing that for many years beforehand as part of the squad and the murder gang and all of that. And that's well hashed out. And of course, Ballyseedy commemorates a series of massacres that happen over the terror months, March and April in 1923.
It is exceptional. So it is a one-off monument, it seems to me.
Oh, yeah. It's
a brilliant monument for what it commemorates.
And you see, there is a woman in this monument, believe it or not.
Yeah, yes.
And that is based on the story of Eileen O'Connor, who was the wife of one of the men blown up in Ballyseedy, John O'Connor. He was a merchant seaman, went back and forth between Liverpool and Ireland, and was arrested because, of course, he was implicated in importing arms in for the anti-treaty IRA. She came to Tralee then to retrieve his body after he'd been killed at Ballyseedy, and was arrested herself and imprisoned in Kilmainham jail for a week or two, and then released, and very sad afterlife after that. And indeed, she left a young child in Liverpool when she was coming. So that mother and child scene is about that treatment of Eileen O'Connor, and I suppose treatment of anti-treaty women in general is sort of represented here. But what is represented in Ballyseedy is the massacre. And you're right, Stephen Fuller, who survived this, and is the only eyewitness other than the National Army soldiers, and whose statement changed the story of Ballyseedy. Because, of course, what was read into the Dáil by Richard Mulcahy was what was fed to him from O'Daly and the Kerry command.
Complete fiction.
Complete fiction that they...
Just in case anyone doesn't not familiar with this case, this is where 9 anti-treaty prisoners were tied around a landmine and they exploded it. It's a war crime, no matter what way you parse it.
They were prisoners.
And one guy, this guy Stephen Fuller, was miraculously blown away, and he lived to tell the tale.
He did.
And if he hadn't survived, we wouldn't know about this. Now, talk to me about Knock na Gcosán, because that was the case that led to Ballyseedy, and that was where Free State soldiers were lured into a kind of a booby trap, right?
A trap mine, yes.
That's a little bit different than tying somebody around a mine, I would suggest. Anyway, explain, Mary.
You could suggest that was part of war. Now, it's a pretty particularly nasty element of war. It is what we would effectively call today a roadside bomb, IUD. So the local anti-treaty IRA in Knock na Gcosán with Cumann na mBan sent a letter into the barracks in Castle Island where the National Army were based there, with information saying if they go to this place, they will find a dugout where the local anti-treaty IRA are hiding. Went to the place, it was actually a trap, there was a mine, they moved some rocks and exploded and blew them sky high, killed quite a number of them, including friends of O'Daly's who were Dublin Brigade members and a local Kerry man who had joined the National Army. There were survivors, horribly injured. So again, we do have eyewitnesses to that. And then this is the reprisal. And the reprisal here, Ballyseedy, Countess Bridge, Carrasavine, and there was, which I only heard for the first time at the Kerry Conference, a fourth attempt at Castle Island, actually, to do the same thing, but the mine didn't explode. And that this is what is called the Terror Months. But of course, we have...
But it was an attempt to put a monument at Knocknagoshal, though. What happened to that?
Oh, yeah, the monument to Knocknagoshal is there. It's tiny compared to this. It's just, you know, a granite headstone with the names of the people killed. It has been sledgehammered maybe 3-4 times over the years. It's now behind a iron fence. So you can see it, but you can't swing a sledgehammer at it, basically. And, you know, interestingly enough, it wasn't touched during the centenary commemorations.
But they've changed the wording on it as well, Mary.
And they've changed the wording on it. Quite neutral.
So the old wording said something about national soldiers who were you know, tragically killed at the spot.
Yeah, yeah.
And the new wording says, dedicated to the memory of the people on both sides who died as a result of the Knocknagoshal
bomb. Yes, yeah.
Right. So with the new neutral wording, it's been left alone.
It has been. Yeah. Right, because, of course, after the Knocknagoshal bomb, they went through the area and they did execute, as well as the Ballyseedy crowd, they did execute a local guy in a field who was presumed to be the blacksmith who made the bomb for Knocknagoshal, but actually it was his brother who hadn't had anything to do with it. And so all of this memorialization is about competing memories, about competing sides in the Civil War. But the Ballyseedy one has come to represent all the atrocities that were committed in Kerry during those terror months, and indeed the entire time from August 22 until really the end of 23, because the violence continues in Kerry. You have a lot of killing continuing on in Kerry that will make it into John's records, I'm sure, until the end of 23 by the National Army. And Ballyseedy is very emotive, even to this day, the monument itself. In fact, I think it would be even more emotive. It's unfortunate in its placing. It's on the side of a very busy motorway. So you can't easily stop and actually go to the monument itself.
Hmm.
But there were, interestingly, on the centenary of Ballyseedy, I think there were three different competing commemorations on the day.
So the war goes on, the memory war goes on.
Sort of official commemoration at which Micheál Martin made a speech. Then Sinn Féin, Mary Lou MacDonald was there. Now, interestingly, she went to Knocknagoshal as well on that day, and then Republican Sinn Féin, where there was a 32 County Ireland has still not been achieved type speech.
Yeah.
So the idea, you know, we can see in the commemorations as well, everybody goes and has their moment to do their commemoration. There still isn't that unity of, you know, commemorative memory, even 100 years later.
I'll tell you, I want to go back to Caitlin here and this image, Caitlin. This is the North Tip Republican Monument in Nenagh. And our old friend Martin Hogan is here as well, apparently. But just talk to us in general about the monument, because I'm assuming a lot of these would have gone up in the 1920s when Cumann na Gael was in government, right?
Well, this one in particular, it's a little bit later, but Cumann na Gael are still in government. It's in 1931. And aspects of what John has mentioned, what Mary has mentioned, they're all here in the North Tip Republican Monument as well. It's very much reflecting, as John was saying, you know, the local communities in the area. There's the speech of the 32 County Republic not yet being achieved. But it's August 1931. And it is put up, they get approval for it in June 1925. So they get approval quite early. They're on the ball quite early. They want to use this space to commemorate the dead of the War of Independence. And later on, then they add in the Civil War, but only the anti-treatyites in the Civil War. And so you have, I mean, one of the first names up at the top is, because it's from all North Tipperary. So Thomas McDonagh, being from Clochjordan, of course, executed after the 1916 Rising. He is mentioned on this monument as well. But so are, as you said, other people from North Tipperary, all men who were killed in the pursuit of Irish independence, including Martin Hogan. And what's interesting about this monument, I mean, it's finally erected in 1931, but its life starts far earlier than that. So there's another committee in the town, another committee who are wanting to put up a memorial to the First World War, and there's a suggestion in 1927 that perhaps this committee and the North Tipperary Republican Committee could perhaps create a unified monument to the men of the First World War.
How could that be?
Well, they have a few councillors in support. They have people who are advocating for it. And then one of the local councillors comes out and says, they're not our dead. Talking about the war dead. They're not our dead. We cannot have something unified. Because this, and it's clear to see from the photo, you can see it right in front of the courthouse. The monument is in a very prolific, important space in the town. And there's a tension over who gets that space, who gets the most important, the most central plot. And I think it's kind of local politics as well. But on the day that the war cross is being unveiled, on the 11th November 1928, they haven't yet raised the money or built this monument, but they decide that's the day they're going to put down the foundation stone for this. And if you knew the town of Nina, it's about 500 metres up the road. You have two conflicting events. Sean McBride comes down and unveils, who's buried just outside here, he unveils the foundation stone. He makes a speech about the still working towards a 32-county republic. And then a few years later in August, Frank Ryan comes down. And he, of course, the editor of An Phoblacht, really prominent anti-treatyite IRA member. And they get a huge turnout for this. You have about 6,000 people. The population of the town at the time is around 6,000. But you have people coming in from the areas all around. You have a huge procession around the town. And then Frank Ryan gives this speech in Irish first and then in English. And it's not something maybe we have time to go into today, but the monument changes then as the decades go on. There used to be a soldier up on the top of it. And in the 50s then, Christ the King replaced the image of the Irish soldier. And in the 80s...
Why was that? What was the logic behind that?
Well, the locals reckoned he was too ugly. The soldier. His name was Jamesy.
Right.
He's now in a back garden in Longford.
Okay.
To a woman who collects statues. But they didn't like the look of him. They thought he wasn't refined enough. And so he needed to be replaced. And Christ the King comes along then in 56. But then in the 80s, so there's four sides. This one side was left blank with the intention, of course, that there would be more people from North Tipperary who would die in pursuit of this 32-county republic. But in the 80s, funded by NORAID, it was the names of the Longkesh hunger strikers who were inscribed on this monument, and their names are still there today as well. So it changes meanings. And again, we've been talking a lot about commemoration, how it's all about what's going on in the present. It's very much contemporary concerns reflected on this piece of stone.
From what you're saying, Caitlin, it seems to me then that the Cumannaigh government was quite happy to allow people to memorialise wherever they wanted, in a way to let off steam, if you like.
They were far more, talking to people whose parents were involved in the original committee, they said they had snipers surrounded around the monument in case the army, in the weeks leading up to it, in case the army tried to interfere. But just in general, I mean, even we've talked already about how there are far more anti-treaty monuments that are erected in this period. And in general, the Cumannaigh government is far more lenient than, I suppose, to compare them to the Northern Irish government.
Yeah, what's happened in Northern Ireland?
Well, it's interesting. The exact month and year that this monument is being erected, there's a planned monument in Tyrone, just outside Strabane. And it has been funded by the local community and by a group of emigrants in Philadelphia. So they've got the money for it. They've commissioned it. It's made and it's about to be put up. And in the weeks before that monument is due to be put up, Regulation 8A of the Special Powers Act is brought in, which specifically talks about monuments. And it prohibits the erection of any monument at odds with that could disturb the peace. So essentially at odds with the Stormont government.
Right.
And so that doesn't happen. The police, they inform the local community if they try to put this monument up, there'll be repercussions. Now that regulation is only enacted twice, in 1931 in Tyrone and in 1938 in Newry. But I think it's a great comparison that you have this anti-government monument being erected in Nina, and you have one being prevented in Tyrone.
Well, I mean, maybe the Republican side is getting the last laugh because Roger Casement is going to be commemorated in this lovely spanking new stadium in Belfast, it looks like. we'll see what the Billy Boys think of that. I tell you what, now, one of the things is that one of the sad facts about, of course, the Civil War is that it officially ends exactly a century ago, but it doesn't end really, does it, John? Let's move on to this one. Explain this monument to us.
Okay, so this is Noel Lamass, who was the elder brother of Sean Lamass, who, of course, was the Taoiseach for many years afterwards in the 50s and 60s. Noel Lamass, as you see on the memorial here, was a captain in the anti-treaty IRA. There was the intelligence element on the Free State side, which largely former IRA veterans themselves. They were in CID, which is the Detective Division, Military Intelligence, had a number of grudges against Noel Amass. One of them was that he was suspected of having been involved in killing a National Army officer on the very first day of the Civil War. So Commandant Mandeville supposed to have finished him off, him and a guy called Michael Vaughan on Leeson Street Bridge. Whether that's true or not, I cannot tell you. But there's a number of other rumours about him that he did this or he did that. And he said, one rumour says that he's supposed to have assassinated Sean Hale's TD, the only TD to be killed in the Civil War. Sorry, the only pro-treaty TD to be killed in the Civil War. There was one or two anti-treatyites killed. That's not true because Noel Amass certainly was outside of the country when Sean Hales was killed. In any case, Hales came back after the ceasefire and the dump arms order of May 1923. And the people who had grudges against him had not forgiven him. So they picked him up when he was in Dublin city centre looking for his old job back, which was, I think, with Dublin Corporation. And he disappeared. So over the summer of 1923, there was various initiatives, where is Noel Amass and so on. And finally, his body turns up in August of 1923 at that spot in the Dublin Mountains in Killachie. Just about on the Dublin side of the Dublin-Wicklow border. And by that point, he had probably been dead for quite a few months and the body was decomposed. Now, this memorial, interestingly enough, is in English. So you see it's different from the National Graves memorials we saw earlier. And it says, erected by a few friends. So it's actually not connected with the movement specifically. It's put up by his family and friends. It's a very poignant, and it is testament to the fact that the Civil War didn't stop like a football match at a whistle. So there's violence, as Mary said. Certainly up until December 23, there's revenge killings, there's botched arrests and so on. There's a considerable number of people killed after the official end of the Civil War. But again, one more thing about this. You see, the wording is the same in English this time. His murdered body was found. So this is one of the keys to anti-treaty commemoration, is the sense of grievance and injustice. They use very emotional language, murdered at the spot, his murdered body was found. You know, this is the key to anti-treaty commemoration, the sense, again, of injustice and suffering at the hands of the Free State.
And of course, the question of commemoration isn't just a quantitative question, because going back to your given the figures you gave us there for National Army people killed, the point is, although there's fewer anti-treaty people killed, it's the way they're killed. Like, it's a lot of extrajudicial executions, you know, shot while trying to escape or whatever. So it's the quality of the killings are different.
Yeah, well, this is key certainly to the anti-treaty perception of the Civil War. So if you look again at the, when they're assembling these lists of people, and some people make it onto the list, by the way, and some people don't, which is interesting, but they divide the list into killed in action, shot after surrendering, sought out and murdered. You know, they're very specific about what is, you know, fair play in war and what's not, you know. And again, there's, the perception is, certainly on the anti-treaty side, that they fought with clean hands, which the pro-treatyites, of course, would not agree with, but they fought with clean hands, whereas their enemies murdered their people without mercy, and that's what they would have said about the Civil War.
Well, of course, it didn't even end there with Noel Amass. Kevin O'Higgins, this was this little plaque was unveiled by Enda Kenny in July 2012 and was vandalised within a week and then mysteriously disappeared. Anyone comment on this? Where does this fit into our discussion here?
Just briefly before I let other people in, but like, it does show there is less tolerance, I would say, of pro-treaty memorials. So there is this lingering sense of injustice, and that if you put up a memorial to Kevin O'Higgins, who was the Minister for Home Affairs, the Minister for Justice, the equivalent of the Minister for Justice, who presided over the executions of the Civil War, of which there were 81, not the famous 77, by the way. But if you put up a memorial to Kevin O'Higgins, who was assassinated by IRA members in 1927, you're endorsing the executions, is the way people feel about it. So just like the monument at Knocknagoshal, the monument to Kevin O'Higgins was vandalised and eventually removed. So the monument was on Booterstown Avenue. He was shot shortly after, I believe he came out of Mass in 1927.
And this was put up by Dunleary Rathdown Council.
And interesting that even a monument put up that late, like, coming up to the century after, well, not quite, but, you know, 80 years after he was assassinated, that it would still be.
And I have to say, I wasn't aware of this at the time. So this was right under my radar. Mm-hmm. I only got notice of it recently, actually, at the head school we did in Gonzaga. You know, that's for the schools one. It came up with that.
It's worth noting as well. Directly, that was just across the road from where he was actually killed. But for many years after, on the spot where he was actually killed, there was a a cross in the footpath that had been engraved into the footpath, and I suppose a bit more difficult to smash up a footpath. But that was there for many years, and then that went, I suppose, as part of at some stage renovations on the footpath itself. But it was a much more no wording attached to it, and a much more subtle type of memorial, probably done by people in the locality, really, rather than in any official guise.
Now, I'm just keeping an eye on the time here. Anyone in the audience want to come in with a question or whatever before we wrap up? You can just compose yourselves there. I'm going to move on to the last image, Connor. You probably won't thank me for this. Right. That's not the worst picture, by the way. The worst one is the ones with the sledgehammer, right, where it's absolutely smashed to bits. Connor, first of all, describe what we're looking at here, not the paint, the monument itself, first of all, the original idea. What was the original idea of this monument?
Yeah, so this is a monument that was erected here in the cemetery on the centenary of the Easter Rising, and it lists all of those who were killed during the Rising on all sides and none. It was unveiled around that time of the centenary. And this particular image is from not long after it. It's a few months after it. But it was 4 years later, really, that significant damage was done to it. And it was essentially it's been decommissioned at this point, to use that phrase. Look, I think it's one of these things that there are going to be plenty of thankful PhD students in the future.
Caitlin, what do you reckon?
who will no doubt discuss it and get much word count from it. I think probably one of the key things is that the intention in terms of it was always one that, it was never wished that it would cause upset or any divisiveness or controversy. That's was inherent within the ideas behind it. And I suppose people may say it was simplistic, and I know people have different opinions on it, but it was something that, the intention was that it would be the list of the dead with no judgment or narrative attached to it. So it was kind of unusual in that regard. There's only one other monument, I think, that you could probably point to in the world that is similar to it, which is the one at Notre Dame de Lorette, which, lists all of those who were killed in that region of France on the Western Front during the First World War. And that brings us back to all these questions, that people have been talking about and questioning, and commemoration versus celebration, honouring versus remembering, all of those things that come up as a result.
But maybe Caitlin, you're the expert on monuments, right? So what went wrong with this one?
No pressure.
Do we have another hedge school?
it's an interesting point. I mean, in terms of your work on monuments generally, where does this fit into the story? Instead, the long term intention was to put all the names, of the War of Independence and Civil War right up to the mid 1920s or thereabouts, and I think that's when it began to get controversial. Really,
it was at the end. It was around, and it was mixed in. If you all recall that debate around the RIC commemoration,
yes. Okay.
In particular,
yeah.
Which wasn't attached to here, but it became kind of embedded in that discussion through one newspaper article in particular.
What I think with the especially, you can see. These are people protest. They don't want the names in the public space. And I think what people protesting against it was that the names were, as Connor said, they were all intended to be presented without any comment, just the people who were killed in conflict during those years. But when you get to the War of Independence, so people like the Black and Tans, you get to the Civil War, you're putting names beside each other. I think that's where the tension was. I think that's where people felt quite strongly and quite emotional about, because you had civilians mixed up with soldiers and with rebels and with informers. And I think as well that if there was a place to do it, it was probably Glasnevin. You have people buried here who were members of the Oriel House. You have Black and Tans buried here, National Army, First World War soldiers. You know, there are so many, everybody.
So in terms of, do you think
looking back, that the context should have been warmed differently in advance of this?
I think for some people, it wouldn't have mattered how much context was given or not given. I think because it's still a highly emotive subject, because there's still, as Mary would probably be able to articulate better, a lot of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still a lot of people who feel very strongly about not having these names in the public space, that even if there had been years of context, it may have changed things, but perhaps for some people it wouldn't have mattered at all.
You also have members of, the emotional context of that is obviously there. You have members of the regiments that committed basically war crimes in places like North King Street on that wall. And this is just 1916 we're talking about. And I think it comes back to what we've been really talking about in this, is commemoration is less about history and more about politics and ideology and contemporary concerns, but also the generational inheritance of memory, trauma, and political ideologies that have been passed down through the generations. So to see the British soldiers who marched in from Dunleary, and all those poor young men who thought they were, I don't know whether it's an urban myth or not, thought they were in France, and then they were slaughtered at the bridge.
Man Street Bridge.
I mean, they were picked off one by one, and your heart goes out to them. They were 17, 18, 19-year-olds, not knowing where they were and what they were doing and why people were shooting at them. And they were on that wall, but people would say they were British soldiers being brought in to kill Irish people. So why should they be commemorated on a national monument in Dublin? I can understand those arguments.
But the original idea was that this was a necrology wall. And,
yes.
And Joe Duffy,
and the children are
this,
there. And
he was very upset about the whole thing, right? And he made this point repeatedly. But it didn't matter how often you repeat it, that this is a value-free list of all the dead.
But you see,
the fact of the matter is,
be value-free.
If you commemorate, you're endorsing.
Yeah.
Aren't you?
There's no potential for it to be value-free.
There is no value-free commemoration.
There's contradiction in terms.
So quick comment on the wall, though, if I may. It's interesting, though, in 1916, some people did have a problem with the Staffordshire Regiment and so on, who did North...
2016, North, you mean?
2016.
Some people
had a problem with it, but most people didn't, which is interesting. So 2016 can be fitted into this... Or sorry, 1916... can be fitted into this frame of, the battle that has passed and it doesn't mean anything now. You can remember them all equally. The War of Independence or the Civil War cannot be fitted into this frame, because the meaning, I think, of the wall was people died in this conflict, but the conflict is over now. And for some people, the conflict is not over. That's the key. So the meaning could not be accepted by a certain section of people, I think.
Right.
But I also think perhaps because 1916 was such a boxed off, it was a week, It was very romantic in all sorts of ways.
Beginning, middle, and end.
And it has a beginning, middle, and end. You have the executions, you have the civilians who were killed. And there was a huge amount of emotion about, particularly in fairness to Joe himself, Joe Duffy, about the children who were killed. And we really did begin to think about, other than, the executed leaders and signatories and those who were combatants who were killed, the commemoration made us think more broadly about how entire communities in the centre of Dublin were made homeless, family members killed. One of the people I think about often is a young girl who was accidentally shot when the rebels were retreating from the GPO into Moore Street, and they shot out through
McCain.
A door. Bridget
McCain,
yeah. And hit her in the head accidentally. She's on that wall. There shouldn't be paint thrown on that. But the Staffordshire Regiment are on that wall. The soldiers who did all sorts of pretty horrible stuff are on that wall. Francis Shee Skeffington is on the wall.
Yeah.
So it can't be value-free. There's too much going on there.
Yeah.
There's too much investment emotionally, even though I think, I admire the attempt to sort of close off maybe that part of our history to that sort of emotion. But you can't do that.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen.
Now, anyone else from the audience want to come in before we wrap up?
on the point of the staffs, as far as I know, there is a grandson of one of those guys. Well, no, not necessarily one of the guys that was killed, but a member of the staffs lives quite close here.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure.
And comes in here and is very much, you know, just not an issue anymore.
Yeah. Hmm. But for other people, it is.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. But if I might then add that to the other question, who mentioned the French memorial at the necropolis? Like, that's across the road from the French National Necropolis of, correct, I don't know, there's about 50,000 French buried of the First World War. And across the road, there's 440,000 listed of all the killed in the part of northern France, mm-hmm, because it's only the two departments close to the coast. But I was actually looking for my granduncle on it. He was killed close by, but I've eventually figured it out that he was just on the other side of the border near the Somme. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why he wasn't on that, and I worked it out. But there's never been a question about that.
But I wonder, the question could be from that is, is it an overwhelming by numbers? There's so many numbers on those walls. Whereas here, you have a very discrete number of people.
It's quite small.
It's very personal.
Yeah, I think it is. It is. The scale is an issue. And here, in particular, in this country, you know, everyone is so close to everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. We haven't forgotten. Yeah. Unfortunately. Anyway, thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, lads.
There's a man there behind you.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah.
Hi, thanks very much. I'm English and I'm first time in Dublin, so this has been a real history lesson for me. I just wanted to ask, maybe this is a naive question, who financed this memorial and the one on the slide here?
There's
a wider question. Is it important who pays for these memorials, and does that play into the politics?
Oh, it does.
That's a good question. Connor, on the Glasnevin?
Yeah, no, that was...
They also pay his lavish salary as well.
I'll have to renegotiate the contract for lavishness. That was funded independently by the trust. And that, you know, in terms of any of the restoration work or anything like that went on in relation to the wall, that was always the trust that bore the cost of that. And I suppose going back to the point as well, you know, that there was a very practical issue in terms of the final decision in relation to it, which does come back to, you know, health and safety and the safety of the public, the safety mm-hmm. of the people who are here, which is far, you know, is far, far more important, obviously, you know, when we look at it in its totality. But there's all of these questions as well, which is something that, you know, Caitlin touched upon earlier, you know, in terms of the state in those early days. And we talk about, you know, the pro-treaty side. There was always that kind of shadow of finance lurking around commemoration and memorialization. And it happened here, you know, in terms of the pro-treaty, the funerals themselves weren't paid for, the florist wasn't paid, we weren't paid. You know, they were chasing a bunny years and years after, and it wasn't, you know, in that context, it wasn't beyond the Department of Finance at the time to have a full-blown argument over the price of a paperclip.
But just to answer your question a different way, I mean, I think one of the things come out of the discussion here is that there are far more anti-treaty monuments because they tend to be non-state. In other words, they were private fundraising and so on, you know, but the state allowed them to go ahead, not in Northern Ireland, as was stated. Do you know what I mean? But they were tolerated, it seems to me.
One interesting thing, Tommy, I know we're short on time, but one interesting thing to think about is that the Irish Free State actually agreed to pay for and build a First World War memorial before it ever built one to the people who died for Irish independence, let alone the Civil War in Island Bridge.
The Irish state was actually the only state outside of in Scotland, England, Wales, Ireland, Northern Ireland. It's the only government outside, apart from England, who contributed to the cenotaph in Whitehall. But the only other government to contribute a cent to anything was the Irish Free State.
As well as the memorial in Island Bridge.
When was that built?
So it was finished in the early 30s, and Caitlin probably knows it.
It was allowed it to in
go
38.
To rack and ruin. You know, I mean, in a way, that's a weird one, the Island Bridge Memorial.
Yeah.
Because you build a memorial, first of all,
yeah.
and then you allow it to go to rack and ruin, which becomes a memorial in itself of forgetting,
eventually.
You know. And then it's revamped, you know.
Eventually, but I mean, nevertheless, I mean, it was the 1960s before the Irish state built an official memorial to the people who died for Irish independence, which is the Garden of Remembrance.
Yeah.
And that is interesting, you know. I won't get into the meaning of that, but it's something to ponder.
And I think even just to kind of, you know, I think there's a quote from W.T. Cosgrave on, he was invited to a commemoration, a World War I commemoration in London, and he wrote to decline. He said he wouldn't attend, he'd send someone in his stead. And just kind of all our talk today on memorials and monuments and commemoration, he was really eloquent. He said, I'm not going to attend because he participated in the 1916 Rising. And he said he was there fighting against British soldiers. It might offend some people who were there because it's so easy to hurt, but so difficult to heal.
Yes.
Right.
And can I end on a final note?
Yes.
There's absolutely no memorial to Cumann na mBan. National memorial to Cumann na mBan. And that needs to be corrected.
Amen to that. Listen, guys, on that note, I'm going to conclude. I'd just like to thank our speakers here today, Conor Dodd, John Dorney, Mary McAuliffe, Caitlin White, and yourself, the audience, particularly those who contributed from the floor. Now, our next Hedge School, another live one, will be 7 p.m. Wednesday, the 31st of May, in the National Photographic Archive in Temple Bar. The topic will be photographs of historical sources, and I will be asking the question, are historians visually illiterate? So I hope to see you all at that. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.